Hello and welcome to episode 161 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Pete Trainer. So we return after the final bank holiday, as the cliche goes, before Christmas. That slightly maudlin weekend when you realise that basically summer has buggered off and we're headlong into leaves falling and other autumnal stuff. Mr. Weston, have you been enjoying the week without having to talk to me?
It was a splendid week without having to talk to you. And not for that reason, Matt, obviously. I miss you dreadfully. But, yeah, it was good. I had some time off. We had a day off on Friday. We had a long weekend. And I had some time off the weekend before. It's all become a little bit of a blur. But we're now very much into conference season at work. So everything is gearing up around the various, of course, virtual events. Although there are rumblings about people going places and visiting, you know, people and, you know, physical events, not in the UK really, but in other parts of Europe. But given the number of cases of COVID in the UK rapidly rising, I'm not sure we'll be allowed to go anywhere. We'll be persona non grata in every country, but still, that's by the by. So we've been recording and getting ready for our various events on the virtual side. And in fact, I did one for our sister company IDG today, the CIO guys. So I did something around some with some CIOs, so, which was fun. And that's pretty much it, really, other than me fannying about and trying to enjoy having some time off. How about yourself?
It's been, I don't know. I've been basically writing a strategy document solidly for about the last 3 weeks on and off. So it got submitted for our board today. So that's that off my plate. I've recruited somebody to my team. Very exciting. And I've spent most of today actually looking at a spreadsheet full of 13 bids from different companies to become a digital services provider, which after a while...
13?
I know.
It's a lot.
Well, it's G-Cloud. This is what happens. It's all anonymized. You just basically get these endless list of people responding to the question. Some of them get it and you just go, yes, met. Other ones hilariously miss the point, and then you go, that's one off the list, thank goodness, because we'll get down to from 13 to 3 with objectivity reigning. So it's I've got this like deeply held thing that if I'm spending my time doing spreadsheets, unlike many people, I know that many people find that basically they only feel that they are doing worthwhile work if they're at a spreadsheet. I find that if I'm sitting in front of a spreadsheet for more than about 30 seconds, then it probably means that my life is just ticking away from me. However, we did the Fantasy League football auction at the weekend. So some mates of mine have been doing a Fantasy League for 30 years. And it's one of the proper ones where you auction off from the single set of players. And I've done it for a few years. Did it on Zoom because obviously social distancing and all that. Which meant I could do it with a spreadsheet. And it was awesome because it meant I didn't completely louse up, as I have done in many years gone, where I managed to not get loads of defenders from the same rubbish team. I managed to only get two players from any one team. I managed to have all money left at the end. It's brilliant. So spreadsheets whilst doing fantasy football.
Spreadsheet for the win.
Good. Spreadsheets, if you think it's work, bad. Anyway, so that's what it's been like. We are joined this week by somebody we've been trying to get onto the show for a while, actually. So it's very good to have you here. Pete Trainer, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a delight, an absolute delight to have you here. What has the last 7 days or so had in store for you?
Well, not in lots store, and lots of things. I've not been in store for 6 months. do you know what? I've been looking at spreadsheets this week. I've been sweating quite a lot of data across spreadsheets, so doing a proper job. That's one thing I've been doing. The last 7 days have been really busy, actually. Valo is, which we'll talk about later, is just in the middle of fundraising. So I've been speaking to lots of investors, doing lots of grown-up stuff like that. We're very, very busy, deep in the middle of kids going back to school professionally and personally. So that's been taking up quite a lot of time. And generally feeling kind of like we're getting back to some kind of normal, just in a slightly bizarre way. So it's been good. It's nice to be into September, I think. Feels like the end of the year's on its way in.
Yeah, it's not been the best of years all round, you know, in a kind of, you know, levels of
We're going to remember it though, aren't we?
Oh, I think, yes.
We're going to remember it, this one. It's not going to be a year that we go like, what did we do that year?
I don't know. I got this terrible feeling every single year for the last, I don't know, 5 years. Everybody's gone, wow, what a year that was. I can't wait for it to be over. And the next one has trumped it with some terrible. Godzilla, thanks you.
There was that year when David Bowie and everybody else died, and that looks like a mere
just a blip
in comparison.
But I think that was 2017, wasn't it? Because it was the year 17, after
16 or 17. Yeah.
Well, 16 was the bad one because that's where lots of really bad stuff happened, which we won't mention. And then, like the year after that, lots of famous people died, and I think it was just their way of going, "We're not hanging around for what's coming next."
Yeah,
it's like a premonition
to know. Yeah, they could have just wasted another couple of years and then been taken. Yeah, there we go.
I tell you, since you said getting back to normal, do you know what I did today? I went and I got in my car and I drove and I went and I met somebody, like a business meeting, face to face.
Did you shake hands?
Obviously not.
I was going to say
that would be weird now. Unpleasant. No, we didn't shake hands, but we had a nice conversation, and then we departed, and that was a meeting. And
do you think we'll ever shake hands again?
I don't know. I mean, I think we probably will, but I think the shaking hands kind of thing will have diminished. Right, there'll be people who have kind of. I think if you're maybe a teenager now, you might never shake hands. It might never, or you might really rarely shake hands.
There's something lost there. I remember I might have told this story before because, you know, I'm of that age.
You've only got so many stories, and we've done 161 episodes.
Well, exactly. But my dad, when I started doing the management training job 15 or so years ago, my dad's just before I started doing this job, he said, I'm going to let you into a little secret. Because my dad was an occupational psychologist, so he did it properly professionally as opposed to winging it like I did. And he said, I'll let you into a secret. If at the beginning of a training session you shake everybody by the hand, you would increase your happy sheet score by at least half a point on a scale of 1 to 5. And I kind of didn't know, and I never really tested it, but I definitely anecdotally used to actually see that happen. You know, if a group of people would arrive en masse because they were coming from the hotel together and the bus got delayed or whatever, and then they'd all arrive in a great now my boss at this place, the owner of the company, he would stand by the door and it was like a wedding line. He would greet them all in because he knew where his happy sheets were at. I just felt that was a little bit, you know, icky, but then I knew that I'd had to work extra hard to be able to get 4 or 4.5 on the score overall. Now, without that, what replaces it? Because there is something about the handshake actually enabling a level of social bond. And this isn't just like anecdotal nonsense. There is psychology behind this. What will replace it? Because that thing with the elbow is just bollocks, quite frankly. And, you know, I mean, there's always said that, you know, the French tradition of the kiss on the cheeks was actually far more hygienic because actually it doesn't transmit germs in the way in which shaking hands does.
Yeah, so that's a bit weird. I didn't.
It's not going to happen in the UK, is it?
It's not,
especially now. You know.
No, I think we've, you know, if we're ever going to do it, we're not going to do it now.
The kids are like banging wrists. They've gone from elbows to wrists now, which is.
It's getting closer and closer to the hand. Then though, surely
it is. Yeah. But it's somewhere between the elbow and the hand, isn't it? It looks quite cool. Fist pump.
Fist pump. Like that. I don't know. This stuff serves a purpose, and we're losing it. So anyway. We'll ponder on that. On this week's show, we're going to talk with Pete. There's two areas that we're going to talk to Pete. The thing that I first got to know Pete about, which is around chatbot and technologies around chatbot, but more importantly, how to make chatbots better. And then the other thing is where he is at now, which is about technology and healthcare. So they are interconnected as well. That makes it sound like it's in some way completely disconnected. So let's get on and have a bit of a chat about those two things. So the first time you and I met, Pete, was in Bournemouth at the late departed Silicon Beach, I think in 2016. And you were talking there, and the many events that I've gone to over the years, and most of them can't remember a thing. And there's a combination there of probably having too much to drink in the bar afterwards, and also most content in most events being really dull, especially you go to lots of IT events. But your talk that day about what you were doing at the time around chatbot technology and thinking about designing chatbots and mental health, and how you managed to get a whole load of work done on the back of thinking it was something else for a bank, which was just genius, was something that has stuck with me ever since. So just, can you just give us a little pricey of that work back then about the exploring how to make chatbots into something more than just cheap menu structures?
Yeah, for sure. So the background to all of that was, it was actually the same year that I published my book. So my book came out, Human Focused Digital. It was out that year. And the book, the concept of the book was that technology had become very inhuman, and was driving out quite a lot of strange behaviors in people by the nature of it being designed very mechanically. And it was a very philosophical book. And what I was trying to do was throw in this idea that actually maybe there was a more human way of designing things. So maybe we should be designing more conversations. Maybe we should be designing more personality into our work. Is there something in the data that we generate every day that could make the technology we consume really amplify the very best parts of humanity rather than erode them? So that was kind of some of the core principles of the book. We started looking at the types of technology at the time that we could use to bring those concepts to life. Chatbots had been around for decades and decades and decades and decades, but were just starting to pick up at the time, again, because of things like banks and automating help and support systems, and so on and so forth. So what we were doing with the business that I owned was taking the concepts that I'd written about, and then technology like chatbots, really before they got trendy and a bit rubbish, and seeing if we could bring some minimum viable personality and some more human interactions to digital via conversational interfaces. So it wasn't that I was kind of obsessing over chatbots. It just happened to be a very interesting way of, you know, bringing some of the concepts that I'd written about to life. And we were using voice and chat for a bank. And it was around that same kind of time that I was also doing a lot of work with men's mental health charities and suicide prevention, looking at data, and those worlds kind of collided with each other. And we start to say, well, actually, if we can create this kind of technology that's much more human and much more dynamic and much more engaging in some regards for a bank, why couldn't we bring that over into a topic area that was far more prosaic and far more necessary, you could argue, and to try and bring some of that humanity back into an area, or encourage people to come and talk about their problems with chatbots and so on and so forth. I think so that was the work that we were doing in kind of like 2014, 2015, and then in 2016 we started talking about it quite liberally at conferences and things like that. It was really fascinating, really, really fascinating. And we really did break some boundaries. We did some quite astonishing stuff. I don't think the chatbot technology that came after the stuff that we were doing has been particularly great. We can talk about that if you want. But I think...
Yeah, well, I think it was... one of the things I remember very vividly was you talking about research that you did that showed about the thing about men's mental health, and how, if I remember it rightly, that men, when talking to a chatbot, were more able to use emotional terms and emotional language. And if you told them that they were talking to a person, even if it was a chatbot at the other end, it would have a profound impact on how much they would open up. And that was one of the bits of insight that you picked up on, and then how that might be then be able to be used to be able to help.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did some really humbling research. It was really quite staggering. It came from some of the banking stuff. So it was linking people's guilt, fear, worry about debt and things like that, and realizing that there were very human emotions, and even in the banking process, that people don't want to go and speak to their bank manager or ring up a call center about. And again, bringing those back to some of the same problems that we have talking about our mental health, which is sort of embarrassment and stigma and things like that. What we'd worked out for both those scenarios via the research that we've been doing is that people are way more likely to talk about their problem. They want to talk about their problems, but they're not necessarily comfortable talking to another human being about their problems, be that debt or suicidal ideation or divorce or loss of kind of a sense of purpose and all those things. They want to talk, but they don't necessarily want to talk to a person. So actually the anonymity of a piece of technology that you can talk to has a cadence and some power to it that, that we were really trying to tap into. And I think there's something like genuinely in that, that again, I don't think we've brought that quite full circle to the place that it should be at the moment. I think everything is still a bit mechanical, but I think there's something in these sort of faceless conversations that just help you unpack and solve a problem, or, you know, discuss an issue without judging you, that actually we need to start trying to do more with. I think we're still right on the cusp of trying to do something really interesting with that.
Yeah, because is it anonymity or is it? I think that what you said right at the end was where I was going with this. In it's more about you're not going to be judged by a machine. It's not going to... The thing with a conversation is that when you have a conversation, it's a back and forth, and everything you say is being reflected in a response somehow. And I can say something to you, though it's completely nonsensical, and you might say, "Oh, that's a good point, Chris." But you might be thinking that's just nonsense, and I might be able to pick up on the fact that you actually think it's nonsense, but you're being polite. And all of that kind of back and forth is part of the natural flow of a conversation. It is part of how we communicate. We don't necessarily give all the information we want to give straight away. We're kind of testing the water a little bit. We're building a rapport with a person before we go in with both feet. And that is something we don't need to do with a machine, right? We understand that this is a mechanical, if you like, device. And we can get to the point. We don't have to feel we're going to get it wrong in that sense, because it is merely about the information you are exchanging, not the way you say it. You know, it's not about anonymity. It's about taking away that concern or process you have to go through of trusting the person, of wondering what they're going to do with the information you give them, you know, all of that kind of stuff that goes with a person.
Well, I mean, ultimately, digital in its current form was being designed to solve problems, right? And that was why it was always there. I mean, there's cat memes and, you know, social media trolling and all the stuff that goes on with it. But ultimately, at its core, it was all there to solve a problem. It was to make things quicker and slicker and, you know, speed things up and make us more efficient and automate a certain amount of kind of mundane processes and blah, blah, blah. Like, digital transformation was there to do that. And I think if people want to solve a problem and they want it done in a way that is not, it doesn't have to be sterile. It can be a conversation. You can take the person out of that conversation as long as the conversation remains, if that makes sense. And that was quite a lot we were doing. And I mean, the methodology behind all the work that we were doing and still doing right now, even in the current business, is that, you know, with banks, what we were doing is we were codifying the conversations that we were hearing in call centers, you know, rather than codifying the FAQs into chatbots, which is what most businesses and large consultancies and stuff try to do. They go, "Where's your repository of frequently asked questions? If this, then that, you know, A, B linear responses or whatever." And they turn those into chatbots, or they turn them into Alexa skills or whatever. No, we weren't doing that. We were literally listening to conversations. We built skills that would record conversations and then break those conversations down and then use the assistant side of that conversation as the responses, you know, and that included, you know, weird colloquialisms, that the whole damn shebang. So like all the oddities in the conversation, all the nuances that make having a conversation bizarre, all the slang, like those were going into some of those digitized conversations, and that was where some of the efficacy was coming from, was that it was. But then what we were doing is then we were parsing out certain words like "I" and turning them into "we," so that you always knew you were talking to a machine and not talking to a human being. So it would never, like any of the bots that we were building, either for the bank or for mental health, they were never saying, "I think this is what you need to be doing," or "I've been in this situation before." It was always, "We think this is what you should be doing. We think this is a situation that, you know, could resolve where you are right now." And just by some of the kind of flipping out some of the synonyms in the languages, again, that was making a huge difference psychologically to the way people were responding to it. But naturally, it just felt quite conversational and quite normal and not like codified FAQs. I think there's still quite a lot of research that needs to be done in this space to try and make those things much more conversational and natural.
Yeah, it's interesting how a lot of what you're talking about there reminds me of Eliza, the thing that Wiesenbaum wrote in the early 60s, mid 60s. And yeah, and that program, which was developed it was almost, as from my understanding of it, it was almost there to be able to prove a point, but was never expected to be some sort of Rogerian therapist. But then people started using it and people wanted to turn it into some sort of, you know, medical device. And Wiesenbaum, no, this is not what it's there for. What are you doing? This is crackers. But that idea about being able to, I think that key bit about trying to be like the anti-Turing test, about making it absolutely obvious that this is not
that
a human.
That, I mean, that
is massively important.
So important. I mean, that's the bit, because otherwise you get to that weird uncanny valley effect of, you know, how many of us have gone to one of these weird buttons in the corner of a website, clicked it, started answering questions, and at some point have gone like, are you a person? Because you're not quite sure. Just get it out of the way. Just say like, I'm a machine, I'm called, you know, something mechanical. We're here to help you solve your problems, or we're here to talk about your issues or whatever. Just, you know, it's the elephant in the room. Get rid of it. Just make it unashamedly mechanical, but sprinkled with a kind of a minimum viable personality that makes something relatable. And it's about making conversations relatable and not, you know, faking it.
Yeah, it's kind of sad though, isn't it?
Although now where we're at is with those, so often now with those chatbots, so quickly it will get you to a point where you're basically presented with the menu, and I'm starting to think, have we not moved on from MS-DOS? It's all gone a bit, you know, text interface, and you know, you're having to put the menu up there because your navigation is so bad that I won't be able to guess the right words to use in conversations, and therefore make it clickable with the mouse, and all of a sudden you've recreated a Windows interface. I just find the whole thing a bit bizarre now, and it just seems to have been meandered into nowhere. Yeah.
There was a moment a couple of years ago where I felt like I was being labelled almost regularly as, and the newspapers did it a few times when they reported on some of this stuff. They were kind of labelling me as the chatbot guy, and it was like, it was never about chatbots. It was always about conversations, and we were studying the psychology of conversation and what makes a conversation effective, or what makes a conversation sterile, or what makes a conversation believable. And it just so happened that there were a number of interfaces that we were pushing that through, chat being one, you know, voice being another. And they're almost like happy coincidences that these interfaces are there. But I think what was also happening at the time, and still happens now, is that there are consultancies and agencies and, you know, blah, 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 and design people that go like, right, we're going to sit down and design a chat bot. And in reality, what they end up doing is going back to the spreadsheet and saying, you know, oh, there's a question, there's an answer, and expecting people to be able to get the exact question right, to get the exact answer right. And all they end up doing is inspiring, you know, apathy and frustration with these things. So I think it's all about the psychology of conversation and not the technology part. That's almost, you know, secondary.
But it's ironic, really, because the whole, like, say banking, for example, and certainly contact center industry has try to boil things down to scripts and you know, and flows that I remember somebody, there was a story of a couple of years ago about Deutsche Bank trying to implement some AI to make sort of human conversations, and somebody saying, you know, something of a reversal since trying to make their computer sound like people, since they've spent the last 20 years trying to make their people sound like computers. And that's why, right, we have this, are you a person when you're talking to a chatbot? Because sadly, it could be a person just following, you know, just being a sort of fleshy computer. Oh, right, they said this, so I'm going to say that.
That is true. I've spent a lot of time in call centers over the last, you know, 10 years, and there are some amazing people that work in these call centers, and they do it for long hours, and they deal with, let's be honest, no one calls up a call center because they're happy. They're not ringing up, you know, because they're in a good mood, and everyone's calling them with a problem, and it's usually a problem that they think is way bigger than it actually is. So they're dealing with all this, and then they're having to follow a menu on a screen that's been designed by large corporate consultancy X over there somewhere in Canary Wharf. And it, you know, and so it's no wonder everybody, like, technology's inspired so much frustration in the call center, on the other end of the call. Like, the whole thing's just been an absolute mess.
Yeah, and it's that sort of last, or not even last, no, it's been the resurgence of kind of Taylorist thinking, the contact center, I think, is where we've started to apply the stuff that Ford tried to apply until in about the 1940s, people started to realize that that way of managing people is utterly counterproductive in the long term, because you disempower and you make people pissed off on both sides. And there's a, yeah, it's fascinating to watch how by using machines, we can go through the same mistake, even though we're applying the machines, different sorts of machines in different sorts of spaces.
I mean, just really quickly, it's an almost an interesting way to end this conversation. I stole a huge amount of philosophy from Johnny Ives when we were designing some of this stuff. And he was always going on, Johnny Ives, about, don't ask what you want somebody to do, ask how you want someone to feel. And it, you know, you end up at a very different place. And most of the design in the UX industry and the digital transformation industry have been asking the wrong question. They're asking how you want someone, what you want someone to do, instead of how you want someone to feel. And if you're saying, actually, I want someone to feel reassured, or I want someone to feel, comfortable, that's a very different output than, what I want to do is get rid of those human beings over there because they cost us a wage every month, and replace that with an automated system that ultimately gets people to the right answer. That's a very different output and a very different input.
From that work, about a year ago now, I can't remember when it was that you started at Valor, but you've now gone into a world of, I guess, modern healthcare.
It's a grown-up job.
You've got a job. You crazy kid. Tell us a bit about Valor and what it is you're doing.
It's all, I mean, it's not, a lot of people have not worked out the connection. So it's not, about 18 months ago, when the business that I owned was really starting to look at how you take topics like healthcare, mental health, primary care, you know, things that are being digitized, how do you make those retain some humanity? You know, that was really a space that I was starting to go into. So I was doing less financial services work and way more healthcare work. And I was having a conversation last summer with an extraordinary business called Valor. And we were talking about all the different elements of kind of natural language processing and how we could start to do some really interesting stuff with data and kind of conversational, or the layers of between conversations. So how we could look at the data in telemedicine, and try to help doctors perform more efficiently, or how we could try and make patients, you know, feel more at ease, whatever it was. So all the stuff that we've just been talking about with bots, but the psychological layer of data rather than the interface stuff. And then Valor came back to me and said, look, we've got a much better idea. Rather than you supplying us this stuff, why don't you just come and run the business? And so they made me this proposition, and then last October I took over as CEO of Valor Health, which is a very different role potentially than I've had before. Comes with some very interesting pressures. I thought I was going to spend 2020 doing all the tech stuff and the conversational analysis and kind of emotional analytics and AI stuff that I'm known for Valor, and then I found myself CEOing a online telemedicine doctors on demand service in a pandemic, which has been kind of fun. So Valor, you know, Valor is a business that it's a bit like, you know, the big ones like Babylon and stuff like that, and Push Doctor. We're a telemedicine platform, but really what we're trying to do is pioneer in the space of what I called in my book and online perform at Valor, referred to as the kind of salutogenics. So salutogenics being, you know, how do you help doctors and patients find the cause of an issue rather than just treat the condition? So from conversations that you have between two individuals, is there a way of trying to derive what the salutogenic reason, what the cause of a condition is, rather than just treating the condition? And that's a space that Valor and I are really trying to pioneer in now, is giving people support, you know, almost before they need pharmaceutical care. And it's been remarkable. It's been a fascinating year, and it's an amazing business.
It's an interesting position that the one of the, I think the common misconceptions in the general public about health and healthcare, and it stems from the fact that health and healthcare used to be very different, because we used to die of diseases and then we found that diseases were fixable. So then the patient-doctor thing became a series of propositions about fix me. And then a lot of that stuff that could be fixed, so whether it's whooping cough or diphtheria or scarlet fever or any of those things, were just kind of pushed out pretty much entirely from certainly rich countries. And now we're in a position where actually a lot of the things that people go to the doctor for aren't things that there is a fix at the take some pills, go away level. But a lot of healthcare is still geared around take some pills, go away.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, the salutogenic philosophy comes from a social scientist from the 70s called Antonovsky. And I might have pronounced that wrong for anyone that's listening. I do apologize. And he was very much, he was really interested in the side of medicine that deals with stress. So he basically worked out that, quite a lot of illnesses, not diseases, so not kind of sort of pathogenic, but more kind of salutogenic, like the some almost 70% of illnesses come from environmental stressors. So things that stress you out that make you sick. And if you could fix the stressors, then you could probably stop people getting sick. And therefore, what you might do is free up a lot more capacity within the healthcare system to treat the more pathogenic stuff, like the actual disease-based illnesses, and not have people going down to clinics to deal with stuff that actually they could be dealing with themselves, or they could be dealing with, you know, more holistically, or by lifestyle changes or diet and things like that. Like fascinating, really, really fascinating stuff. And there are quite a lot of things that we come to rely on GPs to deal with that they don't actually have to deal with. Or rather, you could just ring them up and get, they could give you the advice, or you could use a video conferencing service, like, da-da, like, what did we discover this year? That actually we could do quite a lot of our healthcare online in a way that I think some people had adopted, and they realized that data could help them, you know, identify certain conditions and blah, 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 blah. But this year really forced everybody to start thinking about their healthcare in a very different way. And I think what's going to emerge after the kind of the current pandemic is over is a lot of people are going to realize that there is kind of 70% of stuff that they could just be dealing with online or dealing with without having to visit a physical establishment. And again, I just find that concept really fascinating. But it's taken something, an event like that has happened this year, to really push people to have to make that step, or it's kind of forced them into that position.
Do you think we will see, so in the world of office work now, we've currently got this crazy situation with, I think an awful lot of office workers now realising that there are other ways to work. And whilst it might not be from home all the time, certainly in the office all the time for a lot of people now is seeming like a fairly silly approach. But we've got the political thing, which is, you know, everybody needs to go back to the office to be able to protect businesses that run in city centres, which seems to be the basic, you know, thing that's going on at the moment. Do you think we're going to see similar pushback in healthcare about that only proper healthcare, the only proper healthcare is that that's delivered in a GP surgery, and it's not proper if it's done in any other way?
I think we're going to find in the next couple of years, you know, that we find a middle ground to all of this stuff, and that's, you know, healthcare and professional services. I mean, the problem, the big thing at the moment with media and social media and online and all the conversations that are going on, is they tend to be at the extremes. So it's either like you're in the office or you're not in the office, or you're, you know, you're going to the GP or you're not going to the GP. Somewhere in the middle of all of these conversations is a really interesting sort of, you know, omni-channel space where we can do a bit over here and a bit over there, and actually the blend of the two is probably more healthy for us in the long run anyway. So I think, you know, healthcare is going to go in exactly the same way it already is. There's going to be a bunch of stuff that you're grateful that you don't have to wait 2 hours to get, or 2 days to get an appointment for, and, you know, you've just got answers, or you've ordered medicines, or you've done, you know, some of those sort of triage and diagnostic things, you're dealing with your diet and your lifestyle challenges, whatever, things that you can do away from bricks and mortar. And there are going to be things that you want to go down and do, or you have to go down and do. Oh, and guess what? You're not going to be waiting as long to have to get an appointment to do it, because there aren't as many people clogging up the system because they're doing other stuff online. And I think it's going to be the same with offices. I think, you know, banking's already been through it, where because of the 2008 crash, everyone kind of digitized and they realized, like, oh, I don't have to go down the bank to do these tasks, the things that I took for granted that I would have to do. Or I don't have to go up to the glass window to pay in a check. I can do it in that machine over there. And now we're kind of in that space where we've got, you know, something in banking that feels like the best parts of both worlds. And I think the same is going to happen now with healthcare, with offices, with, you know, I mean, it's going to be fairly lumpy for the economy to find that happy middle space. Of course it is. But I don't think we're going to go back. I don't think there's any going back from this year. I don't think we're suddenly just going to start going down to the doctor's surgery again. And, you know, I mean, why would we? It just seems crazy. Well, you're rushed in and out in 10 minutes anyway, so there's no point.
Well, that's true. But I just want to pick on that a minute, because I think we talk about patients and what patients want. And I think, you know, the public or whatever you want to call them, which I think is perfectly reasonable. And but isn't it also about practitioners? So if you're a GP, one of the things that you do is, just as you say, it's kind of you're providing reassurance for the worried well, or you're providing some sort of reassurance for people whose illnesses are brought on by their environment, or that, you know, you can give them some advice in order to help them to feel better by changing something that they're doing. Or you're giving them some sort of medicine who's going to deal with their symptoms, and you're not entirely sure what's going on. You're kind of pretty sure it's nothing serious, and you're pretty much hoping that they don't come back, because by the time they've stopped taking the course of tablets, whatever's causing the problem, maybe it was, you know, self perpetuating or whatever, is going to go away, right? All that's all fine, but part of that practitioner, what they would see, I think, as their great skill, their art, is to sit in front of that person and figure out which one of those they are. Are they worried well? Are they got something wrong with them, not quite sure what it is, but it's not serious? Or actually, do I need to investigate this further? And or do I need to refer them to a specialist, etc.? So at the point you take them away from that face-to-face experience, then I think, this, and this is me sort of just listening to what you're saying and drawing on my own experience, I wonder whether or rather those practitioners will be less willing to do that, because they are then, especially in this kind of litigious kind of age where anything that the doctor gets wrong, then, you know, the NHS are up for a big bill. That to me sounds like a risk for a practitioner that they may not be willing to accept. And whilst I absolutely, you know, a lot of the sacred cows have been slaughtered in this pandemic and around what you can and can't do remotely, but I wonder whether the elastic is a bit stronger than that. I also wonder whether, so I don't know about you, but I check my bank balance. Sometimes I'm sitting idly and I'll click on my bank app and I'll look at it. I don't know why I'm looking at it. Nothing will have changed since the last time I looked at it, but I just did it anyway because it's there and I can. Now, I wouldn't have gone to the bank before if I had to do that, but I can do it on the app. I can, and it's not costing anybody anything. There's no problem there. But also, I am one of those people, and you might be the same because we're, you know, men of a certain age. Takes a lot for me to go to the doc, right? A lot. It takes a, you know, you have to drag me down there because I don't want to be sitting with ill people and I don't want the doctor to give me anything. So I'm not, I don't want, you know, I don't want them to tell me I've got something, because if they don't tell me I've got something, I haven't got it. So that's when I can, a bit like the conversation we had about, oh, I can talk to a computer and that's no problem, because actually they're not going to get all, you know, excited about this. So we'll probably have more interactions with healthcare expertise, if you like, because the computer can do it, then, and we'll unlock a, you know, this tide of people who would be very reluctant before to interact with health service rather than just being able to do it because it's easy and they're going to get an answer. Because I know I would, you know, I'm far more likely to Google something. I think, oh, am I going to be all right, than I am to go to a bloody doctor and all that nonsense.
Yeah, definitely. Can I just unpack a couple? You've just said a lot, and I'm just going to unpack three of those points, right? One, you answered your own question, which I love. So the first one about doctors, you know, feeling uncomfortable about this stuff, or, you know, where's the middle ground? One of the things I've learned the most in the last year is how much the primary care doctors, the GPs that we have, and of course they're of a certain type because they run on a online telemedicine platform, of course, but most of them still do offline work. So what they've been doing is that, you know, they're coming into a space now where they're feeling more relaxed because they're blended. So they're doing quite stressful, you know, frontline work, and then for a certain amount of hours every week, they're doing online stuff, which is, you know, more, much more conversational and perhaps a little bit less uptight. So they find the blend really interesting. They're really benefiting as well from some of the data that's being given to them, some of the kind of, you know, salutogenic information that's being passed to them. The other thing that which has really helped in this world is, and again, the doctors are feeding back. And then they work, you know, with us and for us. So some of them are locum, some of them are permanent. They really enjoy. Is that on an online session, they get 25 to 30 minutes with a patient on Valor. In a GP clinic, a patient is in and out in 10. So they're actually, a lot of them are going back to that relationship-based medicine, which is why they got into the thing in the first place. So the bricks and mortar situation that they're in quite a lot of kind of GP practices is you have a quota, you have to see this many patients every day. You've got 10 minutes to see each one, and they're coming in and they're really not building up that relationship with them. You know, in an online environment, you can actually build a relationship with this practitioner if you really want to. You can come back on Valor, you can come back as many times as you want and speak to them as many times during the week as you need to. So there's a little bit of that. And also those referrals, if you do need to go and get checked out. So I think the doctors are actually starting to adopt this as a really interesting methodology of kind of blended working. Of course, there are a group of people that the doctors would not want to be seeing online and actually would not want to be going online. My parents, who are in their late 70s, they don't want to go on a screen and speak to the doctor. They're quite happy to wait 2 days and go and see the GP if they have to. So they're all hunky-dory about this stuff. Then the other point you made about a certain group of people that have kind of neglected their healthcare potentially because of apathy, because they don't want to go in queue, they can't be bothered, they wait till something falls off before they really seek help. This is once they get into a new habit of checking their bank balance, the equivalent of checking their bank balance, but for their health on a more regular basis, and they go, actually, this is pretty straightforward. I can open up an app, I can look at my data, I can book an appointment, I don't have to go down, I can do it for 10 minutes, I can get this, I can get that. I can look after my mental health in a way that is supported by professional and data, and I can do it much more regularly and I'm not being judged, and all of that stuff that we've covered already in this podcast, many, many things. I think health becomes a habit that just isn't there at the moment, and that's where this interesting middle ground is going to be. And so I'm not saying that this is for everybody. I'm not saying this is the kind of the silver bullet that's going to solve every healthcare woe. But I have a hunch and a feeling that there's a group out there that are underserviced by healthcare or underserving themselves that are going to get a massive benefit from this kind of digitization, this telemedicine layer that's about to start, you know, appearing in our lives. And again, it's not one or the other. It's not one or the other. It's going to be something in the middle.
So that was a fascinating discussion, wasn't it? We know a lot more about telehealth now than we did before. I think that was fantastic. Thank you, Pete. So, Matt, what are you up to this week?
I'm continuing the mad push to be able to recruit a new digital services provider through the G-Cloud framework. Or is it digital outcomes? Digital outcomes. There we go. Bit of that. Football season starts on Friday. Back to proper football in a proper league. Whilst others seek glory. I tell you what, when I look at the lights, and I know, Pete, you're a Crystal Palace fan, when I look at some of the teams that remained in the Premier League at the end of last season, it really, really makes me realise how rubbish we were last year. So I'm looking forward to winning some games, hopefully. How about you, Pete? What's your week ahead? Obviously, you had the beginning of the football season in the big grown-up league.
Yeah, we've got the beginning of the football season, which is great. We've had some good signings. It's very exciting. Bit disappointed we didn't get Troy Deeney. I'd quite like Troy Deeney at Palace. Other Palace fans. I don't agree with that. Other Palace fans will shoot me for saying that. I've got a busy week of spreadsheets and some really interesting investor conversations, actually, and just trying to, you know, keep things getting ready for back to school and cold and flu season, which is now the next bump in the health road for us.
How about you, Chris? What's going on in your world?
I think actually I've got another meeting with somebody. which is, you know, like a bonanza of personal interaction. And but other than that, then lots of preparing, because we've got a CIO conference in October that because we are the end user people and we are the CIO people, we're doing a lot of the work for. So that's a lot of it. And you know, working with the customers, etc. But it's it's a busy time in the world of IDC towards the end of the year. So that's really it for me. Just getting my head down and getting on with that stuff. But it's good fun. And from a football point of view, I don't you know what? I watched the first episode. Do you know that Sunderland Till I Die program on Netflix, which I hadn't seen. You know, as somebody who's been a Sunderland kind of supporter for quite a long time, but I mean, they've been through some terrible times, but their fans are bewilderingly kind of they're just, you know, I've got a lot of time for them, but gosh, they can be very hard to, you know, there's not much logic in a Sunderland supporter. So watching those sort of things makes me feel a bit sorry for them. But and then I watched the first episode, and then I remember what happened in those two seasons that they did that, and I can't bring myself to watch the rest of it. I'm going to have to pass and hope they do a bit better this season.
It's a fascinating series, that's for sure, but not great if you are actually a Sunderland fan. Super, we will be back next week. Who have we got on the show next week, Chris?
We have got, Matt, we have got Dave Rogers, who's going to talk about toxic technology.
Awesome. And I think I've just signed up another guest the week after next, and we've got two guests the week after next, and then we've got another one the week after, somebody returning to the show after completing a two-year project, which he's going to talk to us about, which is very exciting as well. But I'm keeping that
very exciting.
I know, isn't it just splendid? Thank you, Pete. It's been a wonder to talk to
Thanks
you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
And that's it. Thank you for listening, and we will be back with you next week.
Thank you for listening to the WB40 podcast. You can find the WB40 podcast at wb40podcast.com and on all good podcasting channel-y things.